I did this work as part of my PhD on scale lethality with Greg. Details can be found in these papers. I will explain in a little bit what the scale locality is. This is quickly a Navier-Stokes equation. In this talk, I will only discuss incompressible flows, although recently I extended the work to compressible. And in most cases, in most flows that we encounter, the viscous coefficient is small. And some people have a tendency to neglect this whole term together. Although, as I will say in a little bit, this is not correct. Similarly, we have the MHD equations. You have the Navier-Stokes. This is a Lorentz force, current, J cross B, and coupled with the magnetic induction equation. And again, in most systems, the transport coefficients mu and eta are very small. And so, again, people have a tendency to neglect these terms. This is a visualization of vorticity from a Japanese group, the largest turbulence simulation to date, 4,000 cube. And the point from this slide is that I want to show that there is a whole range of scales. You keep zooming in into the flow and you see fluctuations and smaller scales with structures at all scales. And I like to represent this schematically as such. You have fluctuations at the larger scales in the system, all the way to the small scales where viscosity becomes important. And people like to use wave numbers, traditionally in turbulence. And the problem is that how to make sense, how to understand the nonlinear coupling between different scales in turbulence. So that's the issue. How are these different scales interacting? And the way we do this is through a coarse graining approach. Coarse graining, we take this the original velocity and magnetic field, and we convolve them with the kernel. Typically looks like this, has a width L. And what we get out are U bar and B bar. And these are smooth fields. What we did really is average out all fluctuations of scale smaller than L. And what we retain is only fluctuations of scale L or larger. And what we can do now is write down evolution equations for these U bar and B bar. And they look just like this, just like the original MHD equations, with the additional terms in blue here. These account for the effect of the subscales that we've averaged out on the scales that we are describing in these equations. And two important points I want to emphasize here. One is that these equations describe the large scale fields at every point x in the flow and at every instant in time. There is no statistical averaging involved.
Why doesn't the pressure term change? If you take the smallest case, then the pressure has also some.
The pressure is also coarse grained. Mm-hmm. So I mean the velocity and magnetic field, or the velocity field evolves by the coarse grained pressure. So.
What is that scale and saying the averaging, the pressure fluctuations?
Uh huh. Yeah. So the pressure as well is coarse grained, and it doesn't have fluctuations scale smaller than L. And the second important point is that the coarse graining length scale is variable. We're not restricted to any to having the coarse graining length scale to be very large, and we can take it arbitrary. We can take it even very small, and this way we can probe the scale interactions at any scale. Here, for when viscosity and resistivity are small, we can rigorously show that these terms are indeed negligible. So the action of these diffusion terms on the large scales is indeed negligible, unlike for the Burr equations, where without coarse graining. The stress here is just the Reynolds stress and the Maxwell stress due to the small scale fluctuations in the magnetic field. And the turbulent EMF, epsilon, has units of electric field, and it arises due to subscale fluctuations in U and B. We can also write down the energy budget for the large scales, just like we did for the momentum equation and the magnetic field. And aside from being transported in space, you have this pi term, which transfers energy from the large scales to the small scales. And then you have direct viscous dissipation. And again, we can show rigorously that these are negligible at the large scales. So this is a plot from actual numerical simulation. What this plot, this shows the value of the energy flux averaged as a function of length scale, and it's constant all the way until we reach the dissipation scale. So what happens is that energy is transferred to smaller and smaller scales until it reaches dissipation scale, at which point it turns off, and then the direct viscous dissipation annihilates the energy. There are two important points here. One is that this direct viscous dissipation doesn't act at intermediate or large scales. And the other point is that the flux is constant and persists to arbitrary small scales. So no matter how small this LD is, the flux will take the energy to the small scales in the system until it's dissipated. And this is manifested in the so-called zeroth law of turbulence. And this is an empirical law, and first realized by J.I. Taylor in the 1930s. And what this shows, this is a compilation of empirical data by Pearson et al. In 04. And what it shows is a dissipation on a y-axis. And here you have a Reynolds number. So as you decrease viscosity, dissipation decreases initially, but then becomes independent of viscosity. And
you say it's Newton, actually Newton discovered it. He says it's
Newton?
Not resistance is U squared. It's a direct analog of this. Just 200
Isaac
years
Newton
before.
Yeah. Okay. Alright. And this can be explained by the fact that turbulence is able to bridge the large scales by transferring energy to arbitrarily small scales through this blue plot until it reaches the dissipation scales. So now that I've mentioned briefly what the cascade is, we can discuss what scale locality is. So we have this nonlinear transfer from the large scales to the small scales. And the question of locality is this transfer across wave number k primarily due to interactions with the largest or the smallest scales, or is it due to scales of similar size to k? And in the traditional theory, due to Richardson, Kolmogorov, Nonsager, locality was a fundamental assumption in their picture. And the argument goes like this. You have energy at the largest scales. You have energy at the largest scales, and it's handed down to smaller and smaller scales in a multiplicative fashion, from k to 2k to 4k. And furthermore, each of these steps does not involve direct communication with the largest or the smallest scales in the system. And furthermore, these steps are chaotic processes. Then one would expect that any memory of large-scale properties, such as geometry or statistics, or any knowledge of the particulars of dissipation, will be forgotten. And this gives rise to an intermediate range of scales called the inertial range, where the motion evolves under its own internal dynamics without direct communication with the largest or the smallest scales in the system. And this justifies or motivates the idea of universality of the statistics in this inertial range. So scale locality is a fundamental assumption, but it was still at the level of assumption until Kreitchen in 1959 was the first to explicitly check whether locality holds or not. And what he found is that, yes, he concluded indeed using his closure theory, indeed locality does hold, and the cascade is local, just like it was assumed by Kolmogorov. But the first person to actually explicitly check it without any closure assumption or without any statistical averaging was Eyink in 1994, but more importantly in 05. And he concluded from first principles under very weak assumptions that locality holds in turbulent flows. So this is one side of the picture that supports the locality. Then you have another side. Ever since people started doing numerical simulations, starting with Brasseur and Corson in 1987, up until very recently, in 08 by Menini et al., people have a very different picture started emerging. And their simulations, when they analyze their data, what they see is unlike the Kolmogorov picture. You have these multiplicative cascade steps from K to 2K to 4K. What they see is that, well, no, actually, the cascade happened predominantly by very small steps, from K to K plus 1 to K plus 2, in very incremental steps. And these steps inevitably involve communication with the larger scales in the system. So if these are true, and they're independent studies done by many people, if it's true, then it might shake up all our understanding of turbulence. And Kolmogorov, we would have to probably have to throw out Kolmogorov K421 out of the window. And there was very little success in reconciling the theoretical results of Krachnin and Eyink with the numerical results of these people. On one hand, for example, Eyink maintained that these people, the problem in what they were saying was because they used Fourier series. And on the other hand, for example, some of these people believe that the results of Eyink only applied to infinite Reynolds number, which is not true. But so basically there was some kind of miscommunication or breakdown of communication between the two groups. And so Greg, as my PhD advisor told me, asked me to try to reconcile what's going on. And the way we can do that is by analyzing the term that's responsible for this nonlinear transfer. And this is a flux term. It's a function of three velocity modes. Here, U is the straining mode, Uj in red is the advecting mode, and Ui in green is the advected mode. Here you have large-scale strain acting against subscale stress. I use this notation here of Fourier series truncated at wave number k. So basically, I'm describing these as a Fourier series truncated at k. And we can check, this is a cubic quantity. It involves three velocity modes. So people usually talk about triadic interactions between three velocity modes. And the question of locality is most of the contribution across wave number k predominantly due to modes around k, say from k over r to r times k? Or is it just like the numericists have been claiming, that energy, it gets transferred in small steps? P0 here is a very small wave number. You can think of it as being 1 or the forcing scale. And it gets transferred from k minus p0 to k plus p0 with an unlocal interaction, this acting as a catalyst. This is the largest scale in the system, or the most energetic scale. And we can directly check if this picture is true. We can restrict this advecting mode, which they claim as actually the main. So they're claiming here that Uj in red here, the advecting mode, is predominantly due to the larger scales, has most of its contribution from the larger scales. And we can check that by restricting this to a wave number band, which only has Fourier modes between p over 2 and p, so it's a dyadic band. And we can see, vary p, make it smaller and smaller, and see, is this really true? Does it get bigger and bigger and gets most of its contribution from very small p, just like they were claiming? And so, let's focus on this subscale stress now. This reduces to the following, simply because here this is a redundant restriction. P is already smaller than K, so you don't need this constraint anymore. So it's equal to this. And then this reduces to the following, simply because this is a product. Any wave numbers larger than K plus P cannot give a product which has wave number less than K. Therefore, only wave numbers less than K plus P can contribute. This is just the wave number conservation. And then we split this into modes less than k minus p and modes in a thin band between k minus p and k plus p. And then we have a major cancellation takes place between the two terms. And this brings me to the first main conclusion of this work. You have a main cancellation because we are using the subgrid scale definition of the flux. So SGS definition of the flux is usually used by people who do large eddy simulation modeling. And the justification there has been that, well, this definition is Galilean invariant. So you have the cascade at some point x in the flow should not depend on your speed as an observer. But so it's a physical criterion which you want for it to be Galilean invariant. What this shows is that actually this cancellation, or using the SGS definition of the flux, is not just because it's Galilean invariant, but also because it's necessary for scale locality. Scale locality is also fundamental and crucial for people who do LES modeling. So you need to have sweeping effects subtracted when you discuss the cascade, large-scale sweeping effect. So after this cancellation, you're left with this term. I just rewrite it here. And now notice that there are two opposing trends. I want to take, remember, p smaller and smaller, and see what happens to the flux, and see whether most of the contribution comes from small p. Well, as you take p smaller and smaller, this advecting term in red gets bigger and bigger, because you have more energy at smaller, at larger scales, or smaller wave numbers. This gets stronger and stronger, but at the same time, you have this band, it's a thin band between k minus p and k plus p, it gets thinner and thinner. As it gets thinner, you have less energy in it because you just have less free modes in it. And so, which one wins? Is it the weakening or the strengthening of taking p small? And we can rigorously show that actually this term is rigorously bounded by the following. It's p to the minus sigma 4 times p to the half. Sigma 4 in Kolmogorov theory is 1/3, but if you want to include intermittency effect, it'll be slightly smaller, all the better, because this is a minus. So
what is its formal definition?
Here.
Yeah.
Structure function, basically.
Structure function of number, yeah.
Yeah. One is a, it's zeta over p, basically.
So it's S4, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is bounded, if we take it 1/3, this is bounded by p 1 over 6. So taking p smaller and smaller is going to lead to this term, the flux, getting weaker and weaker, not like what the numericists have been claiming. We did a numerical simulation, 512 cube isotropic force turbulence. And remember, this is a rigorous result. It's a rigorous upper bound. So it could, in principle, decay faster than what is implied by this bound. What we found is that actually decays with an exponent 0.45. So it does indeed decay faster. And here, for reference, I show a 2/3 slope. So it's not true that most of the contribution comes from the small, larger scales or smallest wave numbers, where most of the energy exists, unlike what the numericists have been claiming. So what was going on? Why were they saying or claiming what they were? Well, this is what they measured. They measured transfer, TKQ. This is how it's defined. You have thin wave number bands. So you only consider bands between.
How large is the maximum K? Max K, highest wave number in your
analysis. Oh, in the numerical simulation?
Yeah.
This was a 512 cube.
200.
Then sure. So I was using.
How can be P large?
I was using phase shift de-aliasing.
Okay.
So that would give me a maximum K max equal 250.
But you put the P equal.
Okay.
10.
No, I'm sorry.
Exceed 1000.
I'm sorry.
You're missing some mode in your analysis.
No. So this is 100.
P.
This is 100. This is 10. And the biggest K max in the
P
simulation.
The ratio of the wave number.
100 times 10 is 1000. That would
be
equivalence. Yeah.
I'm not sure I follow.
In order to define the locality, you put some parameter P.
Yes.
The wave number ratio.
No, P is not the wave number ratio. It's a wave number.
Wave number.
Just a wave number. Yeah.
So, but the 10. Okay.
So it's not 10. No. P here is the variable. So I'm looking at P. P here equals 50.
Sorry, then P is a wave number. Not
P is just wave number. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a wave number axis.
Not
there are too many P.
Sorry. Well, P is a less scale. Yeah. And this is wave number. So you take the mode between P over
this
two.
This comes out from the proof. I mean, I don't want to go into the detail, but that's it comes out from that.
So it's the amount of amplitude you have from a wave band of this P, right? and it has to be proportional to B, or
I mean, Eyeing and O5 did this analysis in physical space, and he got a stronger bound. He got 2 over 3 here, which is why I put the slope here. I mean, in principle, the only reason I get a small exponent here is because I use Fourier modes.
I guess the point is, this is not physical. This is an upper bound. It's not expected to be the way that it actually is, because you shouldn't try to think about what physics is going to have.
Yeah.
There's no physics. It's mathematics. It's not optimal. We simply wanted to show that it went to zero.
In some around 90 or 91, we published Lizvinov the paper where this is actually a short moment. So you write asymptotics of a 3-point correlation function or 3-mode correlation function when one mode is much less than it. And there are usual fusion rules, and Lizvinov we published long ago, but it was a different. Unfortunately, I don't remember either. Did you try to? No, Lebedev was a little bit. Did you try to compare it with it?
With your analysis?
Yeah.
Greg compared your analysis. We also compared your analysis. But what we were interested here. We do several things at this level. We cannot compare to your analysis because this is at a more refined level in which we take the absolute value of the third order moment. If you want to think about it. And without taking absolute value, then we compare to your analysis. And there is agreement. Yeah. And with a caveat, but yes.
Nobody should compare. Yeah.
Where am I? Yes. So this is what the numericists did. They looked at transfer functions. This says here, they restrict this velocity mode to wave numbers between k minus 1 and k. And here between q minus 1 and q. And remember, what they were claiming is that most of the contribution to this advecting term in red comes from the largest scales. And what they see, so what is the energy entering wave number 50? Most of it comes from 49. Here I'm reproducing their results from my simulation. Most of it comes from 49, it goes into 50, and from 50 to 51. So this is the incremental small steps they were talking about. And then such a transfer inevitably involves the largest scale system or the smallest wave number. So it's these non-local triads, which they claim are dominant in the cascade process, which is counter to Kolmogorov, Kretschmann, and Eyeing. But what happens if we use dyadic bands, so between k over 2 and k, and q over 2 and q, because that's what we use in our proof. That's how we define scales using dyadic bands. What we find is that, well, we can compare to their contribution. Here, energy entering 50 mostly comes from around 25, into 50, and then from 50 around 100. So this is the multiplicative cascade. And this is predominantly, the plot in black, predominantly due to local triads. So what essentially the numericists have been doing is comparing single non-local triads to single local triads. That's essentially what their analysis is equivalent to. But what they were missing in their analysis is that there is an exponentially many more local triads compared to the number of non-local triads. And this relative ratio of the number of local triads grows as you go deeper and deeper into the inertial range. So therefore, the non-local triads have less and less contribution to the flux or to the cascade. Just a conclusion of first part of the talk. The first main conclusion is that SGS flux is a correct definition because it's necessary in proving scale locality. The second is that the sharp spectral filter or Fourier series, one can arrive at the same picture using Fourier series that of the cascade and scale locality, etc. But one important point is that single Fourier modes cannot be associated with scale. You need, you're talking about an eddy or some localized structure in space, you need a wave packet. So you need a dyadic band of Fourier modes. You're talking about something, an eddy of size L, you need so many Fourier modes, and then you want something half that size, you need twice as many Fourier modes to describe it. It's just That's what it boils down to, basically. It was necessary for us to do that in order to address the issue of locality in MHD turbulence. Now, in MHD, there is no something analogous to K41. There's many competing phenomenologies here. But all of them, regardless of what exponent they claim, all of them assume scale locality. But then recently, in 07, for example, in 08, people started claiming, and even earlier, as I will show, people started claiming that, no, it's not local. Quoting Shikoshin Hinayal, there is a short circuiting of the cascade by a direct transfer from the largest velocity modes down to arbitrarily small magnetic modes. So energy gets transferred from the largest kinetic modes to arbitrarily small magnetic energy modes. Alexakis et al. In 05 and Karati in 06, they also did something similar. Here from Alexakis et al. In 05, what I show here, what is the energy entering mode, magnetic mode 20 from velocity field? And they see that actually most of the energy comes from velocity modes at the largest scales. And this is what they were talking about, short circuit. Energy from the largest velocity scales goes directly to the small magnetic scales. Again, this would spell doom to all those phenomenological theories that are competing currently. In a different community, in the accretion disk community, there was also a similar claim. They claimed that, well, there is also direct transfer from the larger scales to the smaller scales because they were seeing some numerical effects. As they increased resolution, their turbulence got quenched. And the answer to that turned out to be something different. But one of their claims was that, well, because of this non-local transfer, we are seeing what we are seeing. So scale locality was cast in doubt in the late 2000s. And we can do a similar analysis like we did for hydro. Here, the flux, which transfers energy across scale, is deformation work here, usual deformation. Here you have turbulent ohmic dissipation. Is energy getting transferred not locally or is it locally, just like in a hydro turbulence? Well, we can focus on deformation work for now, on large scale strain. So this only has contribution from these scales. What is it, mostly from these scales or from the larger scales in the system? Well, this can be made rigorous, but for the sake of presentation, gradient or the strain scales like delta U L over L. And so it scales like this. If H is less than 1, this will be largest at the smallest scales available. So most of the strain, because the velocity turbulent flow is rough, most of the strain derives most of its contribution from the smallest scales available, because that's where it's strongest. And this is what rough means. Similarly, what about the subscale stress? Well, subscale stress is like kinetic and magnetic energy fluctuations. There are some. And we would expect it to scale like this. And as long as the flow is not very rough, as expressed here, has a Holder exponent greater than 0, then most of the contribution to the subscale stress comes from the largest scales available. Well, here, just what this expresses is that there's less energy at smaller and smaller fluctuations. Most of the energy in the fluctuations resides here. And so, therefore, the deformation work is local. And we can do a similar thing for ohmic dissipation, for turbulent ohmic dissipation. And as long as this is satisfied, which all empirical and theoretical suggest that this is satisfied, then this cascade will be due to local interactions. So up to now, this is just discussing total energy in MHD, kinetic plus magnetic, and its flux. What about if you try to refine the analysis more? Because that's what the numerists were claiming. They were talking about magnetic and kinetic energy exchange. So we can write down budgets for kinetic and magnetic separately. And they're coupled through this term, magnetic stretching term. But the magnetic stretching term only involves large scales and transfers large scale energy into large scale energy, magnetic and kinetic. So it doesn't involve a transfer across scales. It cannot be associated with a cascade. So this is not associated with the cascade. And these two terms separately, this is deformation work, and this is ohmic dissipation, turbulent ohmic dissipation. I already mentioned that each of these is local. So you still get locality in this picture at this more refined level. So what was going on? Again, the claim by these numericists and many others is that you have a direct transfer from the largest velocity modes down to arbitrarily small magnetic modes. Well, the problem is similar to what people were doing before. Here, they were looking at transfer from single Fourier modes, more or less, kinetic and magnetic. But most phenomenologies rely on the picture of wave packets colliding with each other. And wave packets require localization in space. So you need many more Fourier. This is just a wave. One Fourier mode is just a wave with infinite extent, spatial extent. What would happen if we do the analysis with dyadic bands, P over 2 to P and K over 2 to K, and see the exchange of energy between kinetic and magnetic? And this is what we find. We find that energy entering wave modes, magnetic modes K equals 200, comes predominantly from kinetic modes at around 100, and as such. And this is reproducing their plot, the numericist plot, where they were using single Fourier mode. And you can see, this is amplified by 1,000 just for comparison. You can see that they were missing the whole point in their analysis, just like people did in the hydro case. We can also derive rigorous bounds and arrive at the same conclusion using mathematics. This transfer between wave numbers K and P can be bounded by P to the 1 minus HU. As long as HU is less than 1, this will be positive. It's expected to be close to 1/3, for example, or if we assume Goldreich-Schroeder, then this will decay at smaller P and get smaller and smaller. So it's not true that most of the energy comes from the largest velocity modes. And we did a simulation, a pseudospectral simulation, 1024 cube, and we analyzed this term. And again, we see something very similar to what we saw in hydro. It's decaying. So contributions from large and larger scales is decays to the cascade across wave number. In this case, it was 100, 200, yeah. And the slope that will fit is P to the 0.7, fairly close to 2/3. So in agreement with our analysis. And this is it. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for the correction. I somehow, I remember all those battles of 90s about this locality.
Uh-huh.
But the way that I understood it in a very naive way was that it's universality at stake. Like, if it's local, like you said, if it's local, but that was the early 90s when some people, pretty idiotic like myself, did not believe that they're actually, that Kolmogorov scaling is not exact for moments different from three. Now, I guess we all convinced ourselves, at least after the sort of basic scalar, that Kolmogorov scaling is not exact.
Uh-huh.
So all moments except third moment contain a large scale in it.
Uh-huh.
So in this sense, it is non-local.
No.
The only thing which is local is the third moment, which is flux.
No.
So I don't. No.
No. What? So
you're talking about MHD somehow.
No. It's not MHD. Even hydro. I mean, you're talking about intermittency, right?
I'm talking about second moment of velocity difference, mm-hmm. or fourth moment, or sixth moment. Only third moment does not contain L.
Uh-huh.
It contains only epsilon. All other moments they contain epsilon r in the power n over 3 times n over r.
So universality, in the sense that we think about it, is universality of the zeta sub p exponents of structure functions. Yeah. So if they can have intermittency corrections, you can still have dependence on L.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, what my question is that in what sense the locality of what you study? You study asymptotics of a triple correlation function, which is not the whole. I mean, you know, the whole transfer is local. Delta uq equal to 4 years epsilon r. That's the end of story. Now, but you want to see the details of it, okay? So now you see the details. So you really ask, if I take this k, how much it comes from this k, okay? Now, if you would say much or not much, how it would impact the scaling of the sixth moment, whether it's universal or not. This logic somehow escaped me. We say that universality is at stake. Now universality, you understand the universality of scaling exponents.
So
I always believe that scaling exponents are zero modes, which are just, you know, conservation laws, which are actually Lagrangian conservation laws of six particle behavior, which determine the six. Now somehow you relate it to some asymptotics of a triple moment, which escapes me how.
The logic is that if the cascade itself is not local, then you cannot expect universality of other moments. There is no grounds for it. We're not saying that, oh, it's locality implies universality. That's not what we're claiming. But it's necessary.
I'm just begging for more wide explanation. I understand what Hussein says, but I still feel.
Sometimes what we're trying to do is saying, one way of saying what we're trying to do is we're trying to say that the Navier-Stokes really is like the Shell model. Let's put it that way. The Shell model has dynamically only strictly local interactions, right, between...
That's a strong statement about the dynamics of energy cascade, which for me, I mean, energy cascade is a small part of turbulence story. And from my viewpoint, it doesn't determine the exponent of a sixth moment. The exponent of a sixth moment involves some geometry, pretty complicated, and it's not related to the way that the system transfers energy. Or it does.
I don't know. I mean, you refine similarity hypothesis, if you believe that, then it is.
Right. Well, we can go back to 30s, what is the refined similarity hypothesis? It's a poor man replacement for understanding where the fluctuation of comes from. I find it very interesting that the question how energy is actually transported. But I really fail to see relation to universality in this new sense.
I wouldn't say that we showed universality.
Just conceptually, what actually changed in the 90s, that before all turbulence was about cascades. That you just ask what goes where, and you ask how. The moment you understand it, you understand all of turbulence. Okay? But at least I personally learned in the 90s that turbulence is much more than that. So there are many other integrals of motion except that which is cascading here, which determines other moments. So this quantity determines only third moment. Now we study this third moment, it's very interesting, but it's about third moment. Third moment is an energy.
Well, no, we're not studying third moments in the sense that, for example, we prove locality of any p power of the energy flux. So that means we're looking at
moment.
Pardon?
Energy flux is a certain.
No. We're looking at pth powers of the energy flux. That means pth powers of the energy flux. So we actually establish locality of any power of the energy flux, which means we're looking at arbitrary moments of the law.
So you take something which is uq, delta uq,
and we take any power.
Treat it as a stochastic variable, raised in some power, and then average.
Yeah.
That takes it ninth moment or sixth
moment. Any moment you like, right.
But sixth moment contains A inside, that we know.
But that's irrelevant. I mean, what we're talking about is the dynamics of the process, okay? We're talking about what actually happens dynamically for the individual realization. We're not talking about what happens statistically. Again, even in the Shell model, you have pure dynamic locality by construction, but you have the same kind of cascade effect. I mean, this traditional way that you view the buildup, the dependence on L, is through the buildup of fluctuations in the course of the cascade, right? And that happens in the Shell model as well. In some sense, you have universality there because you have no direct communication of large scales. That intermittency is built up in the process of cascading down to small scales, right? So we're not talking about the statistical dependence of the higher order moments on L, That's something completely different.
So where it comes from?
Pardon?
Every realization by you.
No, look at Shama.
No dependence on this life scale modes, which is L. How average of all this realization would contain L in this non-trivial
form? Because remember how many cascade steps you went through going from the large scales, right? That's the usual picture, right? The intermittency builds up in the course of a cascade. Every step is local. It doesn't depend directly on interaction with the large scale. But because the fluctuations build up in the course of the cascade, you remember the number of steps you went through.
Exactly. And yeah. The way you remember it has nothing to do with the way you transfer an energy. It's about something completely different.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on having the locale. I mean, I guess the point is that you can... there are different ways of looking at it. The traditional way, I'd say more traditionally the way you're looking at it, is it is based on a successive cascade process. This is the way Kolmogorov and Ansar and others justify universality. Is this way? Because of the fact that you don't directly communicate with the large scales, you have the possibility of forgetting exactly what's happening at the large scales. And then it's only the internal local dynamics of the cascade that you know that depends on what happens in the inertial range.
Okay, I have much to say, I just don't want to, maybe we'll
I don't quite agree that what Hussein said, that locality is necessary for universality. There are a number of counterexamples to that. Actually, in the Prechin model, we're able to calculate the universal exponents precisely in limits where locality breaks down, right? So if you take the limit of C going to zero or C getting very smooth, those calculations are actually based on ranges in which the locality breaks down. So I don't think you need locality, or actually the entropy cascade would be another case, mm-hmm. where I think you don't need locality in order to have universality. But it's part of the traditional argument and justification.
Yeah. Traditional, that's for sure. I just thought that somehow, at least I started to think differently about it. And
As you were,
you asked him.
Yes. Actually, I'm going to ask this question maybe more for Gregory and for Eberhard as well. But in interview with your remarks, Grisha, about how we now believe that really are at the level of the energy spectrum that Kolmogorov isn't exact, there are intermittency corrections. And in view of the connection you made with Richardson's law, then that would suggest Richardson's law isn't exact either.
No, not necessarily.
That was my first question.
Well, there's a lot of question about that, but I get, there's this, an argument due to Krechnin that says that the quantities that are not linear in averages, so like the Kolmogorov law depends on the average energy spectrum to the 2/3 power, those are expected to get anomalies. But things that are linear in epsilon, like the 4/5 law, you don't expect them necessarily to be intermittency. The Richardson thing is actually proportional to the average of epsilon.
Okay.
So
the moment you have epsilon the first power, that could survive.
My next question was, to what extent can you infer one law experimentally from the other?
You were just telling me, Eberhard, the other day that it's very hard to measure Richardson's law to see it experimentally.
Richardson's law is so non-linear function of velocity. Yeah. It knows about everything, not only about second moment. At all moments, all statistics of velocity Lagrangian goes into Richardson.
So
it's the whole PDF of distance.
I think
it could be still Richardson. I mean, it's asymptotically, and when you spend another $1 million, there would be.
It should be.
Yeah. I mean, even though.
Richardson law is harder to measure. Is that correct?
The whole point is what Greg Wilson said. The point is that you need a certain initial for a certain initial separation. If you go in the inertial range, then you can calculate this time T0, which is given by just epsilon and the distance. Again, it's epsilon and distance, right? And out of that distance, you get a time scale. Mm-hmm. And that time scale is 0.1 of that time scale gives you roughly the Bechdler range, which is ballistic separation. Mm-hmm. And then you have to see any Richardson-type behavior. What that means is that time has to be small compared to the eddy turnover time. And the problem is that in any metro flow at R lambda 1000 on Earth, that scale is actually for any reasonable distance is pretty small. It's pretty short. One should actually make a table and see in atmospheric turbulence for what distance one would expect a Richardson law. Actually, I should just calculate it actually. See. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's an interesting question.
I mean, measuring the energy spectrum is also hard, but not. Okay. But it's not, doesn't have this limitation, you're saying.
The what?
In comparison, measuring the energy spectrum is also hard.
Yeah.
But the energy spectrum, the problem is none of the flows.
Yeah.
None of the flows.
We have other questions.
Which is harder? I want to know which is harder to measure.
But measuring gradients is extremely difficult.
So which would you say is harder? Holmgren or Richardson?
Well, Richardson.
Richardson is
much harder.
I just
want to
hear from
experiments. That's why I was so delighted to see it.
I want to point out that the practical Lakemski constraint depends also on the actual quantity of the epsilon. And in this respect, this law is actually important also. So when you are when you're saying that green velocity is going as p to the one to the 1 2, it's actually p to the first power, because all modes within a very thin shell are coherent, so they add up. So this is a p to the first power, and then in the imbalance turbulence you get very very low epsilons because you have this decrease of interaction. So in the limit of very small imbalances, if you go to large imbalances and you keep energy constant, then your absolute locality constraint, it doesn't constrain anything anymore. And for example, for the case of weak turbulence, it's a very well-known case which was solved analytically. But your constraint doesn't say anything about this case because the epsilon is infinitely small compared to the third order moment. So
you're saying that the limit that the cascade is zero?
Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily. It is infinitely.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about turbulence.
In the case when epsilon is infinitely small compared to the third moment, this locality constraint doesn't constrain anything. So what you require is epsilon is some fraction of the third of the third moment. And this is not always true for MHD, because you have...
If you want to turn off the cascade, then...
No, it's a ratio. It's not epsilon in this case.
No. What I'm saying is that you require...
Would it, epsilon is a flux, or is it some ratio?
Flux, for example.
I guess, it was...
So you require that this ratio is of the order of unity, or this is
in some sense, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, so if in weak turbulence, for example, this is proportional to the horsepower, so it is much, much less, and then this locality constraint just doesn't work.
Well, we're certainly not claiming that every situation in turbulence is local, right? Mm-hmm. There are lots of cases where we know that it's not.
Right. And then this is actually the weak turbulence is also local, but it has its own constraint.
Yeah,
it has
nothing to do with it.
So an imbalanced turbulence is also different because the epsilon is reduced.
I guess in the case of imbalanced turbulence, I think it becomes more and more sort of the local. It is local in our sense, but it becomes more and more diffusely local.
But my point was because in the imbalanced turbulence, for example, some people claim because you have locality, you have to have pinning. So your spectrum should come to the same value at the dissipation scale. But there, from a practical viewpoint, two components, W plus and W minus, can have a different dissipation scale. And the ratio of these dissipation scales is basically locality. And this locality becomes, the locality constraints becomes less and less constraining as you go to larger and larger imbalances. So actually, you cannot claim that you have pinning in the imbalance case.
I mean, what you're saying is that you take the limit of the one of the cascades, either epsilon plus or minus, goes to zero, right?
Very small.
The
imbalance. Once for any fixed ratio, epsilon plus or epsilon minus,
then the it will still be more.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead
for
of more
the, for every ratio, you would have your locality constraint, but it becomes smaller and smaller for each ratio. So you can have a larger and larger ratio dissipation scales for W plus R.
And so, in order for those constraints to really be important, you have to have extremely long inertial ranges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So
I agree.
Actually, it doesn't have to do with the inertial range.
Well,
yeah, in this case.
I'm saying the point is that in order for the localities to really become effective, because now more and more elongated triads become important in these very imbalances.
Possibly,
yeah. And I'm saying that in that case, it would still be local in the sense that we're talking about, but in order for things to become really dominated by these, you know, this more diffuse locality, now you need really, really long inertial ranges.
Sure. Yeah.
But if you take the limit of Reynolds number goes to infinity first, then the
locality. What I was talking about is that there was this earlier scope when he was saying if these guys prove the locality, therefore the spectra should come together at the dissipation scale. And that's totally wrong. They don't have to come together exactly because. Your locality constraint is fine, so they will have different dissipation scales, and this difference will increase with increasing imbalance. So from practical viewpoint, there's no pinning, and your locality constraint is not.
So we've given people a tool, and we're not responsible for this. So if they decide to take our van and take too much head with it, don't blame us.
I guess we're probably already.
An observation, a comment. In all your slides, from the very beginning to the end, all the structure are schematized on blobs. So I don't know. But this is not true. Large scale can be sheets, small scale can be filaments.
I mean, it's just a schematic.
But of course, in the actual analysis, we didn't make any assumption about blobs.
Okay, thanks to speakers.